We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrix. Joining me today is Diego Paria, author, mining and petroleum engineer and economist. He's also a portfolio manager focused on global macro volatility and tail risk. How are you today, Diego?
Very well, thank you, Tom. How are you doing?
Excellent. Great to have you. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your path to getting here and why you've chosen so many different professions and that are seemingly different.
Well, I followed the family tradition as an engineer, mining and petroleum, but my dad was also an economist, and somehow that was somewhere in the back of my mind that they were perfectly compatible. And I had the great opportunity, once I finished my bachelor's and master's in Madrid, in the Polytechnic of Madrid, I got a scholarship to do my master's in mineral economics at the Colorado School of Mines in Golden and the French Institute of Petroleum. And that was really an eye-opener for me. I loved engineering. I loved the way, you know, it trains your mind, the tools. But I also loved financial engineering, the idea of using, these tools. And in particular, I would argue that my thesis in real options that really shaped my passion or put the seeds of my passion for options. And that happened around the time in the mid-late 90s when the industry was also getting more active. And I was very lucky to have the opportunity to start my career in London with JP Morgan on the metals and precious metals and foreign exchange trading division. And one thing led to another. I mean, I was found myself in a very dynamic environment doing lots of things and being on the more technical side of the team. I was, more actively researching things like, more complex strategies. And that really gave way to other opportunities with Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch. We're always within the macro commodity space, developed solutions, worked in the markets, managed teams and risk. You're very close to the analysis. And following many years, you find that some of your ideas might be of interest to other people, and that's how I ended up writing my first book, The Energy World is Flat, which went on to be a bestseller, published in English and Spanish and Chinese, and that sort of caught the eye of a number of people, the Financial Times and many others. And as I published a couple of insight columns, the little one at the end with a picture, and one of them was front page of the FT, it sort of led to other things. And I found that process of writing very complementary to managing money, to understanding risk, et cetera. And so all these things, as you said, might seemingly look different, like the engineering, the economics, the markets. But as far as I'm concerned, they're very complementary, and I thoroughly enjoy all of them, where I continue to learn and explore.
So, Diego, when you say that writing really was complementary to understanding, let's say, these markets, is that because realistically you have to really gain a deep understanding to basically teach something, and by writing it helps solidify how you think about that?
Sure. I think it was Cicero, the Greek philosopher, who said, "If you want to learn, teach." And I think I would push it one step further. I think if you want to learn, write. And the fact is that writing, you might think you know something, and you might do very well, but the fact that you need to explain it to someone, and especially if that someone maybe doesn't really understand it, or you might need to take different approaches, different perspectives. I found it incredibly helpful and useful. I use the analogy, you know, writing a book is you have all these ideas, right? And think about them as Lego pieces. You know, you have pieces of different colors, different shapes, different sizes, different textures. And so you have all those pieces on the table. And the question is, how do you want to tell your story? How do you want to tell me this story, all these ideas? And in a way, what you do, what I do, is I try to tell the story in different dimensions. I might say, okay, let's look at the colors. So you sort your ideas by colors. And you might see, for your surprise, that there's no red. You couldn't quite see when you have all the pieces together, but when you put them in order, you know, put the rainbow colors, it becomes very obvious that there's a lot of green, there's very little of this or that. And as you research, and I can give you the example in the energy book, it was, you know, it's basically a book that provides a horizontal view, you know, a sort of cut of the industry that is not the conventional silo exercise. You have lots of books about crude oil, lots of books about natural gas, lots of books about coal, lots of books about, you know, these different energy silos, but not so many that cut across in a transversal way, effectively creating these links. And so when you do that, you realize, well, how about renewables? I would get the question like, and so you have your thesis and you present it, and then it's almost like, you know, the thesis is being challenged by this kind of analysis, things that you would have not asked yourself. So in my case, it was fascinating because as I threw, let's say, different obstacles, different things like, okay, this seems to work for your subset, but how does this fit into the framework? What was fascinating is that not only survived, it actually reinforced the framework. And that was really incredibly powerful because once you're forced to structure your ideas, I mean, we looked at different colors and you find the gaps, but then you looked at, you know, sizes of pieces and you see that your story is mostly small pieces, or there might be a few big ones, and so textures or shapes, right? And so I think in that sense, once you the process of writing the book is probably, at least in my case, 40 to 50% of the time is spent really ordering those ideas. It's really about completing that. And so you might come up with ideas, you read this, it's interesting, you throw it there with all the pieces, and then it's about how do I structure this and what is the best in which it best comes across. And that means, you know, you could think about, you can tell any story in terms of, you know, in the case of my book, it could have been chronologically, right? You just tell the story chronologically. You could tell it upstream, downstream. You could tell it in geographically. You could tell it in so many different ways. And once you try all those pieces, all that, you do all that analysis, you do find those gaps. What I found is that you just have a much, much deeper understanding of your own thesis, for good or bad. I mean, it could well be that you find arguments that go against it, and you should really listen to them and change your view if it's needed. I found it, you know, it's something that since I started doing it, I must admit, it didn't come naturally to me as an engineer. I'm much more of a formulas guy. But I think once you get into the discipline, I found it extraordinarily powerful. And I strongly recommend that people, write about whatever they're interested. It might be gardening. It might be the markets. It could be anything. You mostly write for yourself. And that's something really important. If it happens that it helps other people, then happy days. But I think it's an incredibly powerful process that will help you understand your own ideas better and hopefully be able to articulate them in ways that they also help other people who connect with your perspective.
So, and in this vein, Diego, you recently wrote an article entitled Bitcoin Bubble or Anti-Bubble. You also wrote a book called The Anti-Bubble. So I think this is a great way to frame our discussion, especially for this time in history. So why don't we start by defining what a bubble is and what an anti-bubble is to you?
Sure. I like to borrow George Soros' definition of a bubble, as he would talk about them as assets that are artificially expensive based on a belief that happens to be wrong, happens to be false. This is what he calls a misconception. So a bubble is basically a situation where the emperor had no clothes. Okay, it's an artificial setup. Now, what I did with my sort of engineering hat is to generalize the concept, to generalize the framework. And so what happens is misconceptions can distort reality, but not only through artificially high valuations, which we call bubbles, you could also have artificially low valuations. So the idea, the general concept of the anti-bubble has, I like to look at three dimensions. The first one is assets that are grossly artificially cheap. It's a matter of when, not if, that the valuation will go up. Okay. The second, so it's some kind of extreme value. Okay. It's the mirror image, the opposite of a bubble. The second dimension is it connects with the fact that given a misconception, bubbles and anti-bubbles are effectively mirror images, distorted mirror images of the same misconception. They're two reflections of the same process. So the minute the misconception is understood and the bubble bursts is the exact same moment that the anti-bubble reflates. And in that sense, you can think about the anti-bubble a bit like an antivirus or an anti-missile. It's a defense mechanism against the bubble. So it's a hedge, both in terms of timing and catalyst, because it's the same process. And the third thing that I like to point out is there's an element of risk premia, an element of being arguably contrarian in this bubble. Sometimes you're the odd guy left out, right? But if you think about the relationship between the S&P and the VIX, in my opinion, it's a clear bubble-anti-bubble relationship, whereby artificially low volatility can contribute to artificially high equity prices. And this could be because of both qualitative and quantitative reasons. So qualitatively is the perception of low risk, the idea the central bank put, the idea that mommy and daddy will always be there to support us, to bail us out. And quantitatively, because as you have low volatility, this can feed into things like risk, you know, trend following or volatility targeting or risk parity. These are strategies that as volatility goes down, they're basically forced to lever up and vice versa. So when eventually things blow up and explode with volatility going much higher, then the reverse happens. And so this is a little bit the concept as such. It goes hand in hand with the thesis, which is a very contrarian thesis that in a way, or was when I first published, I think that's a common thread of both books. You know, jokingly, I often say when I first put them out, you would find them in the airport at the science fiction department, you know, like when oil was at 120 and peak oil was 200. And we were calling for the flattening of the energy world in 30 to 50 oil, people thought we were crazy, right? Or you would have a situation where when I wrote the gold book, you could talk about this monetary policies without limits and where we're going and what it meant. And so I think since then, we've moved to more of a current affairs. And then I would argue that the energy book is now history. So in that sense, both books are meant to be more of a framework rather than just a snapshot of or a crystal ball. It's more about how to think about the world. And I think the thesis is particularly helpful given the dramatic distortions and the artificial nature of many things that are happening, as you pointed out, the what I think we seem to agree upon, which is this is a historic moment.
So Diego, you mentioned there that there's basically these misconceptions that we're looking for when we're trying to identify what is a bubble or an anti-bubble. So can you give us an example of, let's say, a positive misconception and a negative misconception?
Sure. Well, misconception is a belief that is widely held, but that happens to be false. And I think in general, if we look back at different bubbles in history, you would see that there are these beliefs that were widely held that they didn't really hold in eventually. To the point of a positive misconception or negative misconception, it's interesting, I guess you're pointing out in which way it challenges the market. But one could be, and there are many of them, but perhaps the biggest one today is the belief that you can solve problems by printing money. And this is fundamentally the biggest issue that I find with current global macro. We live in a situation where the past decade, I summarize it as in one sentence. I talk about the transformation of risk-free interest into interest-free risk. And this is really the result of central banks kind of trying to keep their head above the water. And every single crisis, you know, effectively using and abusing monetary policies to you know, that eventually have or are believed to have no limits. And these are, there's a whole host of misconceptions that I'm talking about. Like in this case, the idea that you can solve the problems, the idea that monetary policies has no limits, the, you know, and so when you challenge these things, you realize, well, I disagree. I think monetary policies has limits and I disagree. I don't think you are solving the problem. What are we really doing? And, you know, this is part of a lengthy discussion, but in my opinion, you're not really solving the problems. You are delaying the problems, kicking the can down the road, right, with debt and other considerations. You are transferring the problem from one country to another through currency wars and trade wars. You're transforming the problem, you know, with inflation and inequality. And you're enlarging the problem with bubbles and other systemic issues. And so, you know, these ideas that might be widely held that monetary policies has no limits and therefore mommy and daddy will always have my back and there's no risk and there's no inflation, you know, another recently, I mean, these are conceptions and misconceptions and beliefs that go hand in hand with the idea of a narrative, okay? And this, there's a fine line here where people would argue, you know, but look at Japan, they've printed for decades and there's no inflation and therefore, you know, the enemy is deflation and versus the enemy is inflation. And you get this people trying to get their point across and creating narratives that can drive the markets. But many of these narratives are 100% you know, false. They're really misconceptions. And therefore, it's a matter of when, not if, that these things give in. The challenge, I would argue, is that sometimes, and I think this is where we're now, the process goes so far that you literally reach a point of no return. And this is in a way what happens. You know, you could think, all right, we have a big crisis. Let's send interest rates to zero. And now that interest rates are at zero, let's print tons of money and lend it to people. Like, you know, pick your choice in terms of the country, right? My fellow country, Spain, is now being able to finance itself at negative nominal yields, right? This is not a reflection of fundamentals. It's the reflection of this incredible amount of money that is being printed.
So, Diego, when you're talking about the delay, the transfer, the transformation and enlargement of all of these different bubbles, are those basically the four main effects of these MMT-type policies?
Yeah, I think MMT is just a whole new level in the new world of monetary and fiscal policies without limits. I mean, MMT stands for Modern Monetary Theory. It's basically arguing in simplistic ways, hey, guys, I'm going to print infinite amount of money. I'm going to lend that to you. You can spend as much as you want. You can borrow as much as you want. And guess what? You don't even need to raise taxes. That's kind of the miracle of, yeah, that's kind of the implicitly into MMT, right? You can actually spend and borrow as much as you want and there's no consequences, right? Including taxes. And that means we can print money and give it to people and whatever you want. And so I think the point we were making is how you go, you know, you past this point of no return, and how difficult it is to unwind in a way this situation. I mean, think about how hard it is if you bring interest rates down to zero, and then you increase basically your amount of debt to infinity, because at zero or negative interest rates, you know, you can afford a $1 trillion mortgage. So can I. The problem is when rates go to 0.1, right? So I think this process of sending interest rates to artificially low levels, increasing the debt to levels where you can't afford, means that you are not able to normalize ever things. So you're not really solving problems. You're patching things, kicking the can down the road. And this is something that ultimately changes. So MMT is just this latest stage of a process that is what I would describe as monetary and fiscal policies without limits, where the current belief is that it works and you can, you know, basically maneuver your way out of crisis this way. But the reality is you're not really solving things. You are, as we said, delaying, transferring, transforming, and sadly enlarging them.
So are we actually seeing more of a passive form of yield curve control when we see these types of negative rates, Diego?
Yield curve control is 100% coming, in my opinion. And what it means, for those who are not familiar, you know, monetary policy historically was really about short-term interest rates. So you as a central bank would effectively... your accelerator and the brake in the system was driven more by short-term rates. And the back end of the curve, you know, be it 10, 30 years, was really left out to a few variables. One was inflation expectations. Other would be your ability to pay back as a government, the currency, whatever, right? But they were relatively forces that would drive on their own. What yield curve control is in a way done in places like Japan and implicitly in other government and other countries that are using QE, is because you're printing money and buying government debt, you're lending money to the governments, you not only lend in the short term, you can start lending farther and farther out. And what it does de facto is you're introducing an artificial source of demand. Okay, someone is going to buy your 30-year bonds, even if you are an absolute disaster, and you are you don't deserve it. You know, and so the minute you have this artificial source of demand that could potentially print infinite amount of money and lend infinite amount of money, you can actually control interest rates, not only in the front of the curve, but also in the belly and the back. And that's what you know, yield curve control has done in certain parts of the world, and what I think it's coming, because as this amount of money printing, as we said earlier, is transferring and transforming the problem. And inflation, to me, is, you know, if I had to summarize the next decade in one line, would be the transformation of bubbles too big to fail into inflation. I think with inflation on its way, the textbook would tell you, hey, inflation's on the rise, the back-end rates are going to go up because of that's what the textbook says. But when yield curve control comes in, you realize that the central banks can't really afford or don't want those rates higher, and they're going to keep them clearly under control. And this is something I've been saying for a long time. You know, the rules of the game have changed. I think, you know, in my opinion, historically, and you look at the textbooks, they would say if inflation comes, interest rates will go up. The problem is if interest rates go up, the entire system, the bubbles that we've created through artificially low interest rates and artificially high present values of cash flows is too big to fail. And so we're in a situation where you can't hike rates and you cannot let rates go as high as they should, because the entire house of cards collapses and you're going to have to bring down rates anyway. So what's the point of, you know, and so I think the central banks now realize that, and they know, listen, guys, we have something that is quite artificial. We can't let this thing go, because if it goes, it's kind of game over. Plus, we're going to have to give even more support. So let's do it preemptively. And we have this is the situation we have now. It's this never ending sort of amount of printing that is feeding the beast, and that is creating, you know, a sense of control and complacency that is extraordinarily dangerous. And I think that's something to watch for in this market. You know, it's something that worries me into where we're going. Because inflation's on the rise. You get bubbles as a bit of a byproduct of excessive liquidity, artificial low rates. But eventually these things are just too heavy. And I think it's going to challenge a lot of the beliefs and misconceptions that investors might hold.
Diego, when we talk about the inflation versus deflation debate, what is the single force that really offsets that entire equation?
The inflation-deflation debate is fascinating because both sides are correct. Let me explain. There are really plenty of deflationary forces in the system. Okay, you have unemployment, weak economic activity. You have obviously technology, demographics, overcapacity, malinvestment, and eventually bubbles. These are all deflationary forces, right? They effectively keep prices in check. The inflation and reflation kind of side of the story, we need to differentiate. The reflation story is really a more benign look of the world. It's, look, guys, we're growing so much and we are in such a healthy state that, you know, we are literally running out of commodities because of healthy reasons, right? Demand is so strong or whatever, and that can lead to overheating. But that what's happening today, I would argue, is more inflation, which is we're printing so much money that this is not so much about the value of things going up, be it your house or a loaf of bread. This is more about the value of the money with which you buy those assets going down. And that's really the challenge here, is you are trying to balance out two forces in opposite directions. You have deflationary forces that are meaningful and powerful. It's like digging a massive hole. And then you're digging or filling that hole with money printing. And what happens here is you have a sense of stability. You have a sense that nothing's happening, that things are stable, but it's really the offsetting effect of these forces. What happens when printing takes no limits, you can literally print infinite amount of money, is that, and this particularly when it's used to try to get out of crisis or create artificial growth, this is something that eventually 2 + 2 = 4. And what you find is a situation of more what we would call a stagflation. So there's no real growth. Everything's sort of artificial, yet the value of the money is going down, and it gets into a negative spiral that can lead to higher prices despite weak economic activity. And that's something many parts of the world are going to continue to experience. You know, it's like, why are house prices going up if there's so much unemployment? Like, dude, it's relatively simple. There's just so much more money being printed. And bad news is we cannot print houses. You can print dollars, you can print euros, you can print many things, but you cannot print certain, real assets. And that's, I think, the key to watch in this balance is how far central banks can go being unchecked in this situation. It's almost like the more deflation you have in the system, the more they can print and get away with it in the short term. But I think these consequences are not risk-free.
You really took real estate and housing prices as an example there, Diego. And considering that for let's say Canada as an example, Calgary, Vancouver, Toronto, they all seem very overinflated right now, but how do you see real estate being a hedge and get against this inflation that we're going to see, or that we are seeing?
Well, great question. I think at the end of the day, the hedge against inflation, the bad kind, the one that you produce by printing money out of thin air, is pretty much any real asset is a good hedge. anything you cannot print. Obviously, they're all not going to go up in parallel in exactly the same way. So some real assets will benefit more than others, and there are many, many other factors. But I think part of the key with real estate is leverage, right? It's not just about the asset class being a real asset that you cannot print. When I think about real estate, you could almost think about it in one extreme as a real asset if there was zero debt. But if the asset class has a lot of mortgages, a lot of debt, then it can behave differently under certain scenarios. And so I don't follow the Canadian market as closely. I know from friends and I can read, but I know that it's quite hot. But in a world where money is being printed, inflation's on the rise, and interest rates cannot go up, because if they do, it's sort of game over, then I think that the room for real assets to continue to go up is significant. Inflation has two cycles or two types. You know, you have what I would call just normal inflation, you know, where 2 + 2 is sort of 4, right? You are in a situation where you print, things lose value. But there's another phase, which is more dangerous, which is inflation expectations. And inflation expectations is no longer just about how much money is in the system, etc. Is you're starting to see the value of your savings disappear in front of your eyes. And at that point, you just want anything but cash, right? And that's the point where inflation can really accelerate. And inflation expectations are tricky in the sense that once you get into that phase, it sort of turbocharges the process. And if you're a government and you've been printing money to get out of trouble, and the value of your money is decreasing at an incredibly fast pace, it sort of forces you to print even more. And this is the kind of the second derivative when things go really out of control. And this explains the hyperinflation that you would see in Argentina or Zimbabwe or Venezuela, right? And that might look far-fetched, but trust me, if you have your money in the bank, or, you know, who's going to pay for this party? I mean, this is this last decade of beyond or the last decade of party of, okay, let's just print our way out and buy everything and everything going up. I think it's relatively simple and clear to understand who's going to pay for the party. Is the people who hold cash, the people who hold fixed income, and the people who hold credit, which are three forms of fixed income in a way, right? Whereby the $100 that your bond, your oil company or telecom company is going to pay you back in 10, 20, 30 years, those $100 are really not going to buy you much at all. And that's part of the problem. You're sort of thinking of this, a situation where, you get these real assets on the one hand that are going to benefit from higher inflation. You have low rates, which are in a way giving you, if they're unlikely to go up, then, you know, provided that you can pay for the mortgage or you're not too levered, they could even be positive carry. And then you have, on the other hand, the risk of a crisis that creates this forced liquidation and would expose the leverage. And in the meantime, you have this other alternative, which is, what do I do with my money, right? Do I leave my money in money markets? And I think the answer is, as acceleration becomes more and more evident, you know, people are going to be leaving this conventional investments or ways to park your money. And this is what I call, very often I call the frog in boiling water, right? You're talking about inflation at 2% is not really a random number. It's something that is scientifically calculated to keep us frogs, you know, in the boiling broth, right? I think this is something to watch for, because if you do the maths, you know, 2% per annum inflation, which is what they've used normally as a ceiling, over 10 years, you've been diluted by 20% compounded, which may not sound like much, but over 20 years, you've lost potentially close to 50% of your money. So this tax is a real, this inflation is a real tax, and it creates this challenge for us to preserve wealth. And what are my choices? You know, do I go into real assets? Do I do it in a levered basis? What are other people doing with the leverage? Because even if I'm a good citizen, other people might not be and may take excessive leverage. And what are the other choices? So I think overall, I would recommend prudence, but at the same time, I think that the expected outlook is inflation's on the rise, interest rates are not going up, and the alternatives are really not that attractive. So if you have zero houses, you're not flat, you're short. So I would recommend that before you buy Bitcoin or gold or S&P, I think people should really own a house, but always in a way that, that neutralizes your short, and in a way that you're not so levered that it would take you out. This is the big challenge, and central banks are really not making it easy on us by creating this sense of complacency, these artificial low interest rates, which are in a way incentivizing and rewarding leverage. Yet, that's exactly what will kill you. So it's a super fine balance to strike, in my opinion.
And just to kind of crystallize that idea a little bit more, Diego, you're talking about these two phases of inflation, and maybe we could think about the first as, let's say, linear inflation, yeah. And then the second could be, let's say, exponential inflation, but that would be kind of marked or kicked off by that loss of confidence, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the way to think about it, yeah.
So what are some of the other ways that you're trying to combat this inflation? What are some of the other anti-bubble opportunities that you see?
Look, I think the good thing about the framework is that if you want to find bubbles and anti-bubbles, just look for the misconception, right? It's not so much about the numbers or ratios. It's more about, tell me a belief that is widely held that we think might be false, okay? And you can look at many of them. I mean, in my opinion, perhaps one of the most important anti-bubbles I mentioned earlier is volatility, and how artificial low volatility is feeding the bubbles. The challenge with volatility is that it's not that easy to implement. Okay, when you buy the VIX, yeah, it's a great defender for your portfolio, but at the same time, it's something that whilst you hold it, it could have very, very negative carry. So the luxury of being long this insurance is so expensive that you end up losing a lot of your capital in the process. So that's a big challenge. But clearly, volatility is a very important anti-bubble and something you want to own the right way. And that's something that I specialize on with the strategies that we manage. Another one that I believe is an anti-bubble is gold. I think gold, in a way, is the anti-bubble of the fiat currency bubble. I'm sure many of the crypto people will claim the same slot. And this is, you mentioned earlier, the article I wrote, the Bitcoin bubble versus anti-bubble. There's really a much deeper debate there, but I think there's a lot of misconceptions in that process. So I would argue that gold perhaps has a privileged position in this battle. I think you just need to look for which one is the, show me the belief or show me the misconception, and in a way I'll show you both sides. Real estate, being one, if you believe, in Spain we have this saying that bricks never fall until they fall in your head, right? That was like really something you would hear in the early 2000s, you know. Or go back to the dot-com bubble and look for the misconceptions there, or today, with many of these companies. So again, there are as many bubbles and anti-bubbles as misconceptions. I'm particularly focused on the macro side, on things like, you can print to infinity without creating inflation. you can, you know, the central bank put is omnipotent and we can control any crisis. These things will never happen. These are all beliefs that I personally think can actually create this artificially high and low valuations that we can take advantage. What we do within our portfolio and our mandate is we run basically an anti-bubble strategy, and we invest across very diverse range of opportunities, which include gold and financial insurance. You know, many options on many things. We have insurance against currencies. We have commodities, we have emerging markets, we have equity markets, we have precious, we have treasuries. So you're really here looking for either protection against assets that are too high, so buying puts on bubbles, or you want to buy calls on anti-bubbles. And they're two expressions of the same process, but from a relative value perspective, the market might be giving you perhaps more value for your money in, let's say, buying call options on treasuries than buying puts on equities, because of the silos that exist between them. And then there's second and third order effects. So you could think about, okay, artificial low interest rates have sent equities artificially high. And you could argue, like I do, that these bubbles are too big to fail. And therefore, they can't really let these bubbles go. So the degree of freedom is the anti-bubbles going up. So I feel strongly about anti-bubbles going higher than bubbles collapsing. But I also believe that it's a matter of when, not if, that those bubbles will be exposed. And once that happens, I think we're going to see something that will be very difficult to control and will require an even greater response from mommy and daddy, which will accelerate the anti-bubble process even further. So the bad news here, and don't shoot the messenger, is I think the damage is already done. And what we're doing is really just, you know, perpetuating this process of trying to keep things artificial and basically have a process that that is just feeding the beast. And the bigger it gets, the bigger the problem down the line. So that's unfortunately almost like human nature, you know, and if you can't blame sometimes the governments of the central banks, because they're just trying to keep their head above the water. And by doing that, they might be bringing us into even bigger problems down the line. But it's a tough choice. And I think this short-term disease, you know, where the political cycle's too short and the elections cycle, the next business result leads to this short-term approach to many things that are, again, creating this problem down the line and potentially much bigger consequences and much bigger size than now.
Diego, can we talk a little bit more specifically about how you really play the gold investment side of your strategy? I know you guys run the Quadriga Smart Gold vehicle. So can you give us a little bit of an idea of if you have miners in that or how you really want to take advantage of that opportunity that you see in the gold space?
Sure. So we run Smart Gold and Igneo. Quadriga Igneo and Quadriga Smart Gold are sister strategies. They follow exactly the same investment philosophy. They just have slightly different weights in the components. But there are really three main parts in the strategy. The core component, I'm going to talk about Igneo, which is the 300 million vehicle offshore. This one has roughly about 50% in precious metals. It has, which is the building block number one. It has about 25-30% in US treasuries. And then it has a third component, which is the more explosive, which is options. Now, to answer your question on gold, I believe we focus primarily on gold, but there's also relative value in other precious metals like silver, platinum, palladium, or gold miners. Now, the way we think about this is we believe gold is the one in a way, and that will always dominate the portfolio. But we have the ability to rotate out of gold into things like silver or gold miners if we believe that those are particularly very depressed. So when gold is under pressure, silver might be even lower, miners might be even lower. So we think about this as more of a mean reversion strategy. So we like to accumulate this when they're very cheap and we convert back into gold when things normalize more. But look, there are funds that specialize purely on the gold mining side. For us, it's more of a big picture kind of index diversified rebalancing. And we do it, very importantly, we do it no leverage, linear leverage. So if you have $100 and 50 is in precious metals, that's it. We have 50 notional. So that's very important. And also we have a clear long bias. So we're not allowed to short things. So if I want to be long silver, it's at the expense of reducing my position in gold. The other thing that we do is we buy insurance, we buy puts. Why? I use the analogy of climbing a mountain. You know, when you climb a mountain, even if you're an expert climber, I don't know, every 5, 10, 20, 30 meters, whatever, you might pin yourself to the wall so you can actually continue to climb. Yeah. I think in the markets it's a bit the same. If you make money higher than you want to buy puts and kind of secure your position, and that gives you effectively a synthetic call profile. So you're long, you buy put, you create a call profile. And this idea of a rolling synthetic call is something that we try to do. It doesn't mean you have to be long the puts, but we have a preference to do that. But there are many variables that come into play. So again, we have a core long with a long bias, with the ability to buy puts and the ability to do relative value across the pieces. The second building block is very similar. We do something almost identical for US treasuries and TIPS, where you have a core long, you can change duration, you could buy puts. But the third thing, that even if it's only 20-25% of the portfolio, these are options that we only buy options. And we have an average about 10-to-1 payout. So, you know, think about your sporting bets, right? You're on your team where you're betting 10 cents to make a dollar. The worst thing that could happen is you lose your 10 cents. Best thing is you could make a dollar. You could monetize your bet once you're up at 30 cents or 50 or 70. And in order to get these odds of 10-to-1, there are several functions or several variables that kick in. It could be volatility is artificially low or correlations are artificially low or whatever. So when you think about the insurance, the market is trying to predict the probabilities of certain events happening. And sometimes in the markets, we find that these probabilities might be artificially low or high. So to give you some example, you know, you could say the market believes, if I ask you, what's the probability of gold going up 10%? You might say, well, that's a 20% chance. All right. The question would be, if gold is up 10%, where's the dollar? And most people would argue, well, the dollar has collapsed, because if gold is higher, the dollar's collapsed. So the idea is, what about gold higher, dollar higher? And the mathematical models think that's virtually impossible. It's just not going to happen. So if you were to combine insurance that says, I want gold higher and let's say euro dollar lower, you know, or dollar Canada, you know, the scenario where you have gold higher, dollar Canada higher, from an insurance perspective is extraordinarily cheap, because the models don't see that. They say, come on, if gold is up, then the Canadian dollar must be up. And so there's potential scenarios. We like to use it versus China or Taiwan or certain markets where the odds are really, in our opinion, completely off. And you might be able to buy 20-to-1, 30-to-1, 40-to-1 bets that even in small amount, if those events happen, they can be super explosive or asymmetric. And this is part of the reason why we were the best hedge fund in the world in February 2020. And one of the best throughout the COVID crisis, because you know, you want, even if gold did badly during that time, you have insurance that is extremely asymmetric that will make money when you need it the most. And for those who follow soccer, I know in Canada you have maybe other sports you like better, but you know, this is more of a defensive or goalkeeper strategy, right? Is the idea that when you build your team, you need strategies that will make money either in benign markets, but I would argue that you also need strategies that will control the ball and make money during different scenarios, and also defenders and goalkeepers. So we play that role of a goalkeeper, even if both in the markets and in football is one of the most difficult jobs. you need to be there, and you want to make sure you're there when the team needs you. But when I think about the portfolio team and how gold and volatility play out, I think they're very valuable pieces to contribute to the entire performance of the team. I think many people make the mistake of thinking that I want the portfolio and I want my 30 lines in the portfolio to be green. And the problem is when that happens, the 30 lines in the portfolio could also be red. And so this is what I call false diversification, is confusing a portfolio with a lot of stuff with a diversified portfolio. The true thing that you want is to be truly diversified so that when crisis come, your goalkeepers and defenders can do well. And when the market is in a much more benign or bullish scenario, you have the opposite. As long as you choose your players so that they can actually do their job and you can rebalance them, I think this is a winning team in the long term. If you play with 11 strikers or 11 goalkeepers, I think this is a problem. So I think gold has a role to play in the portfolio. The way we do it might be complementary to the way many of the listeners might be doing it. We're very, very focused on the option side, and that's in a way our edge. And there are fantastic other strategies that might look into opportunities more on the mining space in a way that we wouldn't capture. But I think it's all about building that team, and again, this mindset of striker, midfielder, defender. Hopefully, will make people understand the need to be truly diversified and not fall in the trap of false diversification.
Yeah, I think the way that a good way to kind of tie it up would be you want to diversify your risk, not necessarily your asset class, right?
Exactly.
Perfect. Excellent, Diego. I think that's a great place to kind of wrap up our conversation here. Do you have anything else you'd like to add before we conclude?
No, look, I would say that this is a fascinating time. It's, we're in a new paradigm shift. Some of the rules of the game are changing. And I would, be careful with the leverage. I think these complacent markets can create dynamics that get people to take more risk than they need or wish or want. So mind the leverage, even if it's very tempting. If people are interested in learning more or being connected, they could reach out through LinkedIn or Twitter, Parrilla, RRL. I think it's anywhere outside of Spain will miss the RR. I hope the ideas will be helpful, and I look forward to staying in touch and supporting in any way we can.
Excellent. And of course, we'll have all of those links in the show notes. Diego, thanks so much for your time today.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you, Tom. All the best.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.